and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost. I'm so happy you're joining me, and I'm super appreciative of you for supporting this podcast at least $5 a month. There's many of you out there who are going above and beyond, and I super appreciate all of you too. I've really been enjoying telling this story about Poland, and from your feedback, I know you guys have been enjoying it too, so that's great. Some of you who asked me how many episodes are in this series, to be honest, I don't quite know because I'm not finished writing it yet, but rest assured, it's probably about as long as the 30 Years' War. I mean, that would be fair enough, considering we've got about 100 years to cover here, whereas 30 Years' War has, well, 30-ish, so there you go. Last time, we examined a turning point in Polish history when the Commonwealth's nobles, for a combination of reasons, declined to ratify the Treaty of Vienna, thus forcing the proposed anti-Russian League back to the drawing board. For a bit of context, in case you couldn't remember all that well, the Treaty of Vienna would have basically linked Poland to a load of other countries that weren't all that a big a fan of Russia, and that would have probably led to a series of conflicts between Russia and this Treaty of Vienna League, which included Britain and the Holy Roman Emperor. There was no indication that Tsar Peter would never face any opposition to his gains, because George of Britain-Hanover was still on the case. But certainly, the Tsar had gone to great lengths to ensure his security, and the attempts to dislodge him from his new positions along the Baltic would be immensely difficult. As spring faded into summer 1720, we also saw how King Augustus of Poland reconciled himself to his status as really a de facto vassal of the Tsar. Though still presented, ostensibly, as an alliance, the Russo-Polish agreement ensured the security of one power to the detriment of the other. The entire experience had taught Peter that Russia needed a friendly commonwealth on its border, and now that this could be achieved by force, this was all the better, while Augustus had learned the difficulties in branching out on his own. There could now be no question of allowing Poland to drift, and the best way to further consolidate this relationship and cement his own legacy would be to end the war with Sweden once and for all. So that was what Peter sought to do in the summer of 1720. Let's examine how he managed it as we take you to June 1720. The Great Northern War was 20 years old by the time Tsar Peter learnt of the diplomatic defeat of the Treaty of Vienna. Over the course of the conflict, everything had changed. But when Peter was persuaded to join the war in 1698 by Augustus, the King of Poland had been secure in his position, and Poland was seen as the stronger power in comparison to Russia. And not only that, but Augustus ruled over a commonwealth which was recognised as the de facto end of civilization in Europe. Beyond the Polish-Lithuanian border, it was said, there existed backward, barbaric states, still Christian, or at least some uncouth version of it, but leagues away from the cultivated splendour of the West. The Polish penchant for Oriental trends and fashion added to the mystique and grandeur of Augustus's kingdom, even while, deep down, it was dangerously brittle, as Charles XII of Sweden would prove. Over the course of the struggle, Augustus's fragile power base had vanished, replaced by one reliant on Russian money and soldiers for its security. Just as Russia replaced Sweden as the predominant power in the north, so too did Peter replace Augustus as the most important partner in the alliance. Peter had been the last figure standing after Charles XII's initial rampage. Having weathered the initial storm, Tsar Peter had managed to inflict the worst defeat upon Sweden in living memory, arguably since Nordlingen during the 30 Years' War, or perhaps before that, since the time when Sweden capitulated to Denmark and signed a really unfavourable peace treaty at the beginning of the 17th century. At that point, Sweden had been at war on all fronts. King Gustavus Adolphus had elected to make a costly peace with the Danes rather than fight on against hopeless odds. Adolphus's great-grand-nephew, if I'm getting the tricky Swedish family tree right here, was quite unlike him, even if Charles XII's conquering brilliance echoed that famous Swedish king of the 30 Years' War. Charles's ultimate weakness, his literally fatal flaw, was his unwillingness to compromise and recognise when he was beaten. As shocking and defining as Poltava had been in 1709, Charles never regarded that crushing defeat as anything more than a momentary setback. To his credit, Charles kept finding men that he could send against his enemies once he returned from his Ottoman vacation. And even while he had been in that exile, his machinations with the Ottomans can be seen as directly responsible for forcing the Tsar to drop his Black Sea ambitions. In this, at least, Charles could tell himself that he had succeeded, that he had hurt Peter's pride, just like Peter had so wounded his. Yet the best opportunities Charles had for peace were always turned down, and because the king viewed the entire experience as that of an unjust war forced upon him by his neighbours, the thought never seemed to have crossed his mind that peace, however hard to swallow, would be the best option. We've spent a great deal of words already trying to explain Charles's behaviour, his incredible stubbornness, even when it was blatantly obvious to all that the war wasn't winnable, probably lost the Swedish Empire more than Peter's victories did. Another king would have made peace immediately after Poltava, but Charles was not another king. He was the closest thing that the early 18th century had to a military genius. Perhaps only the Duke of Marlborough came close to his tactical skill and ingenuity. He was the last of the great Swedish warrior kings, and his death in battle by some unknown Norwegian hand completed the picture of mystique still further. The stunned Swedish soldiers didn't know how to respond to their king's death. For so long he had seemed invincible, not affected or touched by the realities of the battlefield. His death essentially tore the heart out of Sweden, even though the war didn't end for another 3 years. He wasn't exactly mourned, because by the time of his death, the Swedish people had been enduring the equivalent of total war for nearly two full decades. The treasury was empty, the country was emptied of young men, and the harvests went repeatedly uncollected. A succession of plagues over 1715-18 had wiped out a third of Stockholm's population, while freezing winters in the interim locked the country to its perpetual misery. With the king dead, the average Swede would surely have hoped that this end of an era would represent an opportunity for change in the fortunes of war. Maybe under the new regime of his sister, peace would be at hand. Because of this, Charles's citizens found themselves, almost despite themselves, maybe thanking God for their king's death. Finally in tune with the expectations of the people, Ulrika and her husband, Frederick of Hesse, set about dismantling the anti-Swedish League, one player at a time. Some of this we've looked through before, but it deserves refreshing so we're all on the same page. Baron Georg Heinrich von Goertz, if you can remember him, had established a set of ideas and daring opportunities during his feverish diplomacy between 1714-18. Goertz had been killed by the misplaced grief of the Swedish people, but these same citizens were perfectly happy to see his initiatives developed for their own benefit. After his death and that of his master, the new regime made much of its new position to its enemies, and attempted to use this renewed willingness to bargain as a kind of credit which its war-weary neighbours would be eager to avail of. Peace was made in rapid succession with the Danes, Hanoverians, Saxons, Poles, and Prussians from late 1719-20, but the price was always high. Under the auspices of Georgian planning, the giveaway of Swedish lands had been made easier by the explanation that Sweden would receive its compensation from Russia in the Baltic. This had been the plan, and George of Britain-Hanover appeared on course to make this plan a reality. Rousing all potential allies, George used his strong position and the spectacle of the Royal Navy to compel Sweden's neighbours to join a series of interconnected alliances. With these set up, and with the Holy Roman Emperor on side, it now remained merely to get the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth on board. Once this was done, the League would become anti-Russian in all but name. As we saw last time, though, the Polish enterprise misfired once the Sejm of early 1720 failed to approve of the Treaty of Vienna. The Republic's nobles resented what they saw as their king's creeping attempts to bypass their constitution, and in particular, to establish his family in an absolutist position. These fears about what King Augustus might do were fires which were gleefully fanned by the Russians, who reasoned that in the event of a war with Russia, which seemed a possibility by early 1720, the Commonwealth would be vulnerable to Augustus's schemes of hereditary absolutism. Through a combination of factors, be they bribes, threats, or manipulation, the majority of the same refused to approve what could have been a great step towards independent action in the Commonwealth, and the Russian noose around the Poles was further tightened. Georgian diplomacy had relied upon the Polish partnership, and with this up in smoke, there was no discernible way to make the Treaty of Vienna work. Its promises and aims to guard the Commonwealth against Russian incursions and soldiers sounded hollow when that very Commonwealth would not approve these measures. The Holy Roman Emperor's assessment of the situation was a sober one. No anti-Russian league could possibly be effective without Poland and Prussia, for without Prussia it would not have enough troops, and moreover, it was dangerous to seek out the Russians so far away and leave the powerfully armed Frederick William, the King of Prussia, behind without being sure of his intentions. If money failed to hinder the Russians from intriguing in Poland and to deprive them of the dangerous ascendancy that they were gaining there, the Swedes could land in Royal Prussia, the anti-Russian nobles would join them, and all factions would cease. In October 1719, the Emperor had stated definitively that he would not participate in any plans for a northern alliance before Poland had acceded to the Treaty of Vienna, prior to joining such an alliance himself. As you're probably noticing, the whole scheme was fraught with too many difficulties. The Poles were unwilling to pull their own weight, and it was impossible to drag them in. The imperial court, therefore, having discerned the effects of the plan for reducing Muscovy to her former bounds, and having reached the conclusion that military action against the Tsar was doomed to failure, was going to try and gain his favour while keeping the plan alive, insofar as this was necessary for bringing pressure to bear upon the Tsar. As the Emperor sought to somehow keep the plan alive, George sought to keep the threat of war alive. He still had an alliance with Sweden, and he was confident that some determined displays of force in the Baltic would persuade the Tsar to see sense and at least agree to British mediation. Mediation became the new order of the day in Georgian diplomacy, and in May 1720, the endurance of the Elector King's policy was given another shot in the arm when Queen Ulrika of Sweden essentially abdicated in favour of her husband, Frederick of Hesse. Frederick's coronation as King of Sweden meant that Hesse and Hesse's German allies were now tied closer to the Swedes, which was a positive, but the factor which George took most encourage from was Frederick's rampant Russophobia. Frederick of Hesse despised Russia, and he believed emphatically that the best course open to Sweden, now that she faced Russia alone, would be to court British military aid, in addition to the financial aid she had already received. With this accomplished, there was no reason why Sweden could not bring about a turnaround in her fortunes and force Peter to agree to mediation. But Tsar Peter had been playing the northern game for far too long now to allow some minor German prince to turn the tables. Seeing British collusion with the Swedes at sea over the spring of 1720 as an inherently hostile act, Peter still refused to take the bait and simply ignored the action. Under the advice of his admirals, most of whom hailed from Europe, Peter determined to continue the attack on Sweden with his more mobile galley fleet than to actually engage with the 20 English and 11 Swedish man-o-war vessels. But the perceptive Tsar made efforts to advance his case on the diplomatic front as well. He made it abundantly clear to all English merchants and envoys who could be found that his quarrel was with King George and not the British people. Such clarification was possible because even while Peter had expelled the British and Hanoverian ambassador from St. Petersburg, he had ensured that this city remained open to British trade, and in July 1720, he stopped blockading Swedish ports altogether. Clearly, the Tsar was trying to send a message to the British people, and fortunately for the Tsar, several events further shaped the situation in Britain, which favoured Russia even more. In an era of seismic personalities, we should not be surprised to see the first glimpse of perhaps the most famous British politician of the 18th century, Sir Robert Walpole. Robert Walpole was a highly educated Whig statesman in the old style. Short and round, with several double chins to spare, sorry Robert, but it's true, his appearance was less important or impressive than his phenomenal skill for governance and direction. Walpole had come to power in Britain in the aftermath of the bursting of the South Sea Company's bubble, a somewhat complicated event, wherein Everyone essentially lost a lot of money and lampooned the government and the king for what had occurred. In a Britain before the era of prime ministers or even properly defined cabinets, Robert Walpole deserves the distinction of being the first prime minister of Britain. And this status was thanks in large part to the sheer level of responsibilities which were laid at his feet, as George and eventually his son George II discerned in this portly gentleman a skill and political acumen which only came around once in a generation. Robert Walpole's foreign policy is where he truly interests us, though, fascinating as his rise in political career is. Perhaps best described as something of a realist, with a smattering of ideological baggage and reserve, Walpole viewed Russia as a potential trading partner and friend. He viewed partnerships and subsidies with the Swedes as a waste, and he considered war with Russia to be an absolute catastrophe. War, in Robert Walpole's mind, was pointless unless it could bring Britain some tangible advantage. That he was, then, in opposition to King George's wishes was a blow softened by Walpole's deft handling of matters in Parliament, where he expertly parried and defended accusers of the king and the government in all affairs, emphasising the encouragement of trade and the economic benefits which would come from colonial expansion. Walpole embodied the later obsession London would have for its empire and then its Commonwealth of Nations. The best way to ensure that trade flourished was to avoid war at all costs, and for the next two decades, Walpole would hold Britain back from continental commitments as the colonial commitments were expanded. That is, of course, until everyone piled on in the War of the Austrian Succession in 1740. In summer 1720, though, George and Robert Walpole were trying to find a compromise over their vastly different interpretations of British foreign policy obligations. George perhaps accepted that he couldn't win the political battle against Walpole, but he still hoped that the fleet already sailing in the Baltic would have the desired effect. Robert Walpole did not waste time. By the end of August 1720, he had sent word to the ambassador in Sweden that he wished to cancel Britain's treaty obligations, barely 6 months after they had been signed. The Anglo-Swedish alliance would expire in January 1721, and so George informed King Frederick of Sweden, the new king who was formerly Frederick of Hesse, that he had until then to persuade Peter to come to terms. George informed the new Swedish king that Britain could no longer mediate or guarantee anything, and that Sweden's only hope would be to somehow stun the Russians with an unexpected victory. In short, what Robert Walpole was really saying, nothing but a miracle would save Sweden now. The Tsar was already aware of the changing political winds underway in Britain, because of course he was, and he sought to drive the point further home in Sweden by welcoming the Duke of Holstein into his lands. The Duke of Holstein, you may or may not remember, was actually a nephew of the late King Charles XII, and the Holstein party had been the other pretender to the Swedish throne, alongside the so-called Hesse grouping, which was now in power. By welcoming the Holstein party into Russian protection, Peter signalled that he was willing to go below the belt, and suddenly a raft of possibilities were opened, wherein a nightmarish scenario of arrest and exile was imagined by the new King Frederick. This blow was severe, but the terrible raids along the Swedish coast, and further inland by Cossack and Russian marines, eroded the king's will to fight on even further. Frederick did hold out one last bit of hope in Poland, though. While George still maintained a shaky hold on his foreign policy before Walpole's influence was fully felt, George had instructed his envoy to the Commonwealth to argue for a new campaign of pressure, as the same was gathering in Warsaw in September 1720 to discuss the Treaty of Vienna yet again, because despite his earlier setback and arguably his decisive defeat in that regard, George had not given up just yet. Convening on the 30th of September 1720, the nobles and potentates of the Commonwealth gathered in a far less defiant mood than they initially had in January. With the Russian influence thoroughly entrenched by this point, the Tsar had spent the summer of 1720 eagerly and warmly welcoming those nobles back into their Russian friendships from which they had recently been swayed. In addition to this reconciliation, King Augustus had also called on the Russian envoy in his Polish residence and expressed his sincere desire to maintain his friendship with the Tsar. In the tradition of 18th century diplomacy, Augustus feigned ignorance over the question of whether his recent conduct had offended the Tsar, and he reasoned he had sought a policy which would enable the Commonwealth to remain friendly with both Britain and Russia. Caught in the middle of these two powers, or more accurately between the personalities of George and Peter, Augustus insisted that he only wished his kingdom to be a friend to all. He then picked the worst possible time to try and gain some leverage from his position. Unaware of all the facts, Augustus sent a mission to Russia with the aim of posing as a fair intermediary for Anglo-Russian diplomacy. Presenting Poland as a friend to Europe, Augustus's Polish embassy was actually led by Sergei Dolgoruki, the son of the Russian ambassador whom Augustus had only recently called on. But this episode didn't end there. The sums Augustus had given Dolgoruki for the sake of greasing the wheels in Russia were spent all in one go in an all-night bender in St. Petersburg, and Dolgoruki had treated the sojourn back to Russia as a chance to meet with old friends and relatives rather than actually pursue any of Augustus's diplomatic aims. This was because, as Dolgoruki well knew, Augustus's aims were naive in the extreme. Advising Dolgoruki to pose as some kind of priceless intermediary, Augustus didn't seem to understand that by September 1720, the Tsar was in an unassailable position. Peter knew of Walpole's rise and of his conflict with George. He knew of the Holy Roman Emperor's unwillingness to commit to an anti-Russian alliance without the full agreement of the Poles, and he knew of the Swedish desperation for peace. So, Augustus's man, Dolgoruki, was wined and dined by the Tsar, as though he was a privileged Russian noble returning home, which, well, he was. The last attempt at gaining some kind of leverage ended in farce for Augustus, and Peter saw right through his old friend's efforts, sending Dolgoruki with a large gift worth three times as much as the stipend Augustus had given the Russian when he left for St. Petersburg. The message was clear, if somewhat playful. Whatever Augustus could muster, it was a drop in the bucket compared to what Tsar Peter now had at his fingertips. Chastened by his failure and receiving the message loud and clear, it is at this point, really, that Augustus seemed to have switched his focus. From early 1721 onwards, Augustus would invest his energies not in attempting to pursue some kind of independent policy in the Commonwealth's name, but instead, he focused all his energy on having his son approved for the succession to the Polish crown. In this quest, Augustus unsurprisingly had the Tsar's eager support, and thus the contract between the two men became even more important to the Polish king, as familiar concerns superseded national ones. After this flutter in independent policy making, Augustus withdrew into the subdued and pliable relationship with the Tsar, which he has become so infamous for. The recent years had been both enlightening and depressing for Augustus. Considering all that he had experienced, can we blame him for giving up on the Commonwealth and investing his energies in more tangible projects? Augustus had been halted in his efforts to bring the Commonwealth out of its Russian supplication by those same nobles and potentates in Poland whose descendants would later curse the Saxon king's name. It is an uncomfortable fact that during this period of the Commonwealth's history, Augustus was only partially to blame for what befell Poland. Bitter infighting, self-interest, and really unwarranted suspicions were the illnesses that had plagued the Republic since the middle of the 17th century. Augustus's tenure as king only served to show exactly how far these cancers had spread. In the same vein, the frustration experienced by Augustus and his potential allies taught Europe a lesson about Poland which it would never forget. That lesson was, the Commonwealth could not be relied on as an ally, and its people cared more for their archaic constitution than they did for practical promises of aid and friendship. The Treaty of Vienna was the last time the Commonwealth would be viewed as so important to the balance of power in Europe. Never again would its powers rely upon the deliberations of the same when considering their alliances. In the space of 20 years then, and this has to be emphasised because normally all we do is look at Sweden when we talk about the Great Northern War, but the Great Northern War had torn an irreparable hole in Polish independence and freedom of action. Far from interacting with the agents of the same, in the future, the diplomatists of Europe would cynically conclude that it made more sense to negotiate directly with the true master of affairs, the Tsar of Russia. One historian put it best in his conclusion on the Treaty of Vienna when he noted that The Republic's failure to accede to the Treaty of Vienna could only have shown her up as an unreliable and unrewarding partner in the game of international power politics, and it is surely no coincidence that her status on the European chessboard was henceforth reduced to that of a mere pawn. A pawn, indeed, and, as we saw last time, it's more accurate to demark 1720 rather than 1717 as the year in which this status truly began. From late 1720 onwards, Augustus would abandon any semblance of interest in furthering his adopted domain's position, with the Russian threat insurmountable and the Commonwealth magnates crippled by their self-destructive obsession with their constitution. It made sense for Augustus to look out for number one. As the sun began to set on the Commonwealth's sovereignty, it also began to set on the Great Northern War. We opened this episode by denoting that the war had been waged for two full decades. During that time, other powers had come and gone, but Russia and Sweden had, incredibly enough, remained in a state of incessant war without any truces for 20 terrible years. I cannot emphasize how transformative this war had been, because in its duration, all the weaknesses of Sweden were exposed, all the strengths of Russia emphasized, and all the clichés of history brought to bear. It had taken one king, Charles XII, to bring Sweden to unimaginable heights of supreme triumph and power. It had taken one battle, Poltava, to crush this power and eliminate Sweden forever from the military initiative. It had taken one conflict, one desperately long conflict containing several external powers and vast swathes of territory, to turn the balance of power on its head. As 1721 approached, Peter planned to put the exclamation point on this shift with the greatest maritime invasion of Sweden yet seen. Blithely ignoring the Anglo-Swedish naval presence, which now hid in Stockholm's natural defences, Russian forces swarmed ashore in overwhelming numbers and burned their way north and south in their quest for peace. Tsar Peter had never been so militarily or diplomatically supreme, and he knew that there was nothing for Sweden to do but sue for peace. King Frederick, seeing his kingdom's sufferings and understanding that all potential allies, including Britain, were due to fall by the wayside, sent some depressed Swedish agents out in search of a peace. The price would be high. Peter would be granted Livonia, Ingria, and Estonia in perpetuity, while Finland, save its southern portion, would be handed back to Sweden. Russia would pay 2 million thalers to Sweden over 4 years in exchange for these gains, and Sweden could purchase grain from Livonia without the usual tolls, but the agreement was a stunning demonstration of what had come to pass. Just as Sweden had never seemed so hopeless, Russia had never seemed so powerful. This peace, the Peace of Nystad, was signed on the 14th of September 1721, bringing to an end the 21-year war which punctured Sweden's imperial aspirations, ushered in a new balance of power, and represented a dramatic passing of the torch. Sweden went from the upper echelons of the Premier League of European powers to the second or even third tier of states. The Swedish Empire, established during Gustavus Adolphus's 20-year reign as king, was brought down low after a 20-year war. As quickly as it had arrived and changed absolutely everything about European relations, the Swedish Empire was now effectively gone, replaced by an empire larger and more resplendent than anything that had ever emerged from the East before. We have spent a lot of time detailing Sweden's history in this series, which you may feel is strange considering this is Poland is not yet lost, but the incredible fact about Polish history is that it touches off so many other states as this history progresses and ventures into different epochs as it waxes and wanes. Sweden had been the great rival and foe of Poland, and if you can remember back far enough to the adventures of Sigismund III, you'll know that this rivalry was on a dynastic level as well, with the House of Vasa being divided between its Polish and Catholic or Protestant and Swedish sides. The relationship had defined Poland as much as it had defined Sweden, so it was only right to give it a proper send-off here. A lot can, of course, change in 20 years, but not even the greatest imaginations in 1698 could have envisaged the map of Europe in 1721. A watershed moment had occurred, and Europe would never be the same again. Russia had begun its meteoric rise, and the bear had plenty of growing up left to do. In a joyous ceremony, the Tsar's family, close personal friends, and the clergy all passed immense blessings and praises upon Peter in the week of celebrations and drunken revelry which followed the Peace of Nestad. On the 31st of October 1721, Peter appeared before the Senate and explained that he would pardon all criminals except murderers, only to be greeted by the plea that he accept the titles of Peter the Great, Emperor and Father of his country. The 47-year-old Tsar hesitated, but said he would think it over. A few days later, during a church service conducted by his favoured clergyman, the Russian Chancellor rose to the pulpit to address the Tsar, and we're told he performed the following speech. By your tireless labours and leadership alone, we, your loyal subjects, have stepped from the darkness of ignorance into the theatre of fame of the whole world, and, so to speak, have moved from non-existence to existence, and have joined in the society of political peoples. For that, and for winning a peace so renowned and rewarding, how can we render our proper gratitude? And so that we may not be with shame before the whole world, we take it upon ourselves in the name of the Russian nation and all of the ranks of the subjects of your majesty, humbly to pray you to be gracious to us and agree, as a small mark of our acknowledgement, of the great blessings you have brought upon us and the whole nation, to take the title, Father of the Fatherland, Peter the Great, Emperor of all Russia. Peter, in reaction to all of this, nodded his head. He would accept the honours, henceforth claiming the title of Emperor over all the Russians, a title which was justified by the discovery of a cache of texts from the early 1500s that contained a reference made by the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian, to Tsar Vasily Ivanovich as Great Lord, Emperor, and Dominator of all the Russians. Whether the Holy Roman Emperor at the time was merely trying to flatter the Tsar in question in order to induce him to join the Habsburgs in an alliance didn't matter all that much, because here was an example in the 1500s of the Tsar being given imperial honours by a Holy Roman Emperor, and so the Romanov claims to the title of Emperor will be declared historically legitimate and justified. Legal lingo aside, the world had indeed turned. The spotlight which so long had been shining on Russia's neighbours, be they Poland, Sweden or the Habsburgs, would now be turned towards her empire and would illuminate the Tsardom for the next two centuries. Russia would prove greedy in its hogging of the spotlight, and as we'll see, the lighting up of its lands plunged its neighbours, above all Poland, into a desperate national darkness. Next time, we'll row back our narrative a bit and finally analyse that significant event in Polish history, the Silent Sejm of 1717. Having finally brought our coverage up to the end of the Great Northern War, it only took us 18 episodes, we'll be able to examine the infamous capitulation in the context of the era, with some revelations which will probably surprise you, so I hope you'll join me for that. Until next time, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, you've been listening to Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Thank you so much for doing so, and I'll be seeing you all soon.